You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
And isn't it a lovely day?
Oh, I hear it sprinkled. I didn't actually see it, but I did hear it.
Well, it did. It actually sprinkled enough to get the car wet, but not the ground. Interesting.
Well, we're having a little technical difficulty with incoming phones, so I need to get our guest on the line. So I'm going to let Caroline talk for a while.
Okay.
All right, take
First
it away,
of all,
Mom.
how does this lady pronounce her name?
We're going to find that out in a minute.
All right. Okay. Well, this lady has written a really interesting book that's it's about life in Iran, and you know, many of us have wondered what it's really like there, and this book tells you what it's really like there. And so it's once I started reading it, I couldn't put it down because it was that interesting. And other people have thought the same thing. She's a kind of writer who tells compelling stories in rich and lyrical language. This book is called The Sky of Red Poppies, and it's an illustration of her mastery of both. And that was a critique by Judy Reeves, who's the author of A Writer's Book of Days. And this person, Yvonne Nelson Perry, author of The Other Side of the Island, says she has many conditions of the human heart, and she understands these. Sky of Red Poppies is a compassionate story of universal truths. And, of course, that is what we're all looking for and what we're hoping to achieve in this life, is finding universal truths that can benefit us all. And it's the thing is, if each of us does a little bit of good in the world, then everyone benefits. And if nobody does any good, of course, nobody benefits. But this idea of passing it forward, I think, is a very good idea. And I think that's what she does here in this story. It's set against the backdrop of the pre-revolution Iran. Sky Red Poppies is a poetic epic and a powerful read.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. We got her. All right. See, I didn't I'm yakking here.
We had a little technical difficulty on the incoming phone line, and now we've got Zoe. You're going to have to pronounce your last name for me, Zoe.
Garamani.
With us. And Caroline has just been talking a little bit about the book, and my first question for you, Zoe, is why did you decide to write Sky of Red Poppies?
You know, I've lived in the United States nearly 40 years, and in those 40 years, a lot happened in my country. And I felt like I have never done anything for anyone back home. I did have a friend who inspired this story. And so I decided I'd be her voice. And I will let people see the Iranians for who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
Not the glamorous picture that immigrants paint because of nostalgia helping them there, and not the ugly picture we see in the news, but just the reality. So that's what inspired me. And I have three grown children who are born and raised here and know very little about Iran. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be my legacy to them, a little window to open to mom and dad's past.
Wow.
That's what started it.
Now, when the story is set during the revolution against the Shah, were you living in Iran at that time?
No.
So you had already come to the States.
The United States years before that. I actually moved at a time when everybody was moving back because of all the opportunities that there were and the good jobs and comfortable life, etc. But no. I came to live here a few years before all of that.
And what years does this book span? Does the story in Sky of Red Poppies?
It starts in the late 60s and spans to to just recently.
Wow.
So it starts at a time when there were some movements, but a lot of hush-hush, you know, preparing for a change and yet not daring to do anything about it. So that's when it starts. And I thought the best way to tell it is from the POV of someone like myself who knew so little about what's going on.
And POV meaning point of view.
Talk about those who did know.
Well, the heroine or the speaker in the book, we get a glimpse of her life as it is, and she doesn't really know for sure what she hasn't. She has some ideas about what might be happening, but she's not for sure. And I suppose that was true of many people her age. Do you think?
Absolutely. Am I supposed to answer that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the voice of the other lady is sort of in the background. I'm not sure if she's talking.
Oh, I'm not close. I'm not close enough. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
Right. We'll get this set up so we can hear. You can hear a little better.
Okay. So what I was wondering was that the speaker in the book, the young lady, it tells about her life, and she's not quite sure what's going on in her country politically, but she's trying to find out. In a way that doesn't endanger her or her family. Is that possibly what happened?
Yes, exactly. I mean, the parts in this book that are fiction, they are fiction in the way it's presented, but in their nature, they're not.
Okay.
Let's say I write a story about two men calling me from Indiana radio to do an interview. I am changing the gender, and I'm changing the state, but I'm not changing the fact.
Right, right, okay.
So that is how I have fictionalized it. I've changed the names. I've changed genders. I have changed some of the events to resemble another event, but that other event also happened.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't made up things in my mind.
Now, since you weren't living there during this time, how did you learn about these events?
I did live there during the time that what happened there happened. You see, I moved out of Iran in the early 70s.
Oh, okay.
These were happening in the late
60s.
And early 70s.
Okay.
And also, I have siblings who lived there, and they would come and go and tell me stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the narrator is not directly in touch with her friend is because I wasn't in touch.
Mm.
Do you see what I mean? I mean, I was away, but I made it so the narrator could be there but hear stories from the protagonist's family, and the protagonist is in prison. You see what I mean? She was in prison.
Yes.
And I would hear stories about her from a third person, but it wasn't going to her house and meeting her family, and you know what I mean?
Right.
Meetings came way before that. So it's sort of fiction based on reality.
Well, how much like you is the narrator?
Every bit.
So that is your voice.
It is.
Okay.
She is me living the life that I wish I had.
Mm.
Know what I mean? Some of her actions are not my actions.
Right.
Some of her involvement is not my involvement. But emotionally, she is so much me that one night as I was typing the part about her feelings for her father, I was sobbing and typing at the same time, and my husband passed by and said, "You know what? You're crazy. What kind of a life is this?" But then again, he knows I'm crazy because I've done a lot of things that nobody would do. Who would give up a lucrative job of dentistry and university teaching and everything to be a poor writer? I mean, tell me about it.
Now, Zoe, you've also written Sharik Igam in Persian. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Now, that book is not is totally nonfiction. While I was here and after the revolution, at a time when I couldn't go back, my brother was killed in a car accident. Mm-hmm. And so for me to deal with that grief took a couple of years. And during those 2 years, I read every book there was that could help me.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end, when I was back to normal and kind of over it, I thought to myself, what happens to the people who are here and they experience a similar tragedy, but they can't read English? What happens to them?
Right.
So I wrote this for them. And I wrote my take on many of the books that I had read, as well as stories of other immigrants who had experienced a similar thing. It's not always a brother, sometimes it's a parent, sometimes it's a child, sometimes it's a best friend. And so I gave those examples. And in the end, and within it, I've put, because I'm also a poet in Persian, I wrote poetry and everything. And in the end, came out giving them all the emotions that I had in the end coming out of that darkness. And that book is right now being used by a couple of Iranian psychiatrists in L.A., who, when they deal with patients who have a similar problem, they give them the book.
Isn't that wonderful?
This is mm-hmm. going to help you. And
yeah.
it seems to have helped a lot of people, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, that is certainly your contribution to the well-being of many people, because I know what you're saying. When my husband died, I got a hold of every book I could find to see if what I was feeling was normal, you know, to see if it was,
yes. that,
and
mm-hmm.
yeah, and they really helped. They did.
Wow.
Yeah, because that's exactly it. You reach a point where you think, is this ever going to stop?
Mm-hmm.
Am I normal?
Mm-hmm.
And then you read this and you see, you know, I'm not alone. Everybody goes
right.
through a similar thing when they are grieving.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, Zoe, when was The Sky of Red Poppies published?
It was published September 2010.
Okay. And it's gotten some really good notice. Can you tell us a little bit about the One Book, One San Diego event?
We call my book now, jokingly, my writer friends, first of all, they call me their poster child. And, because this is my first English novel coming out and making this big bang here. And the other one is because it got into that program, they call the book, The Little Book That Could.
Oh.
Whole group of readers behind me saying, I think I can. And we could, because what happened in the process, and actually normally today is the day that the votes would be counted and it would be announced which of the three chosen books makes it to the One Book, One San Diego, but unfortunately, something went terribly wrong with the voting system.
Ah.
In that there were multiple votes and there were votes from out of area and things that they didn't know which to count and which not to count. Until that day, I had been ahead by about 250 up to 300 votes.
Okay? Now, this is a contest sponsored...
That was a huge honor because the other two authors are so well known and so great that I wouldn't even compare myself to them. So readers liked it, and readers choose this book. So it wasn't so much what your credentials are, but how much people like you.
Mm-hmm.
So when the voting went suddenly crazy in one day, the organizers shut down the vote to see what they can do about it. Because, you know, it wasn't any of the author's responsibility, but you know, fans can do that. Fans can just go and, when multiple votes are allowed, they could just go and click, click, click and mess up the whole system.
Mm.
So they waited and they analyzed and they tried locking it up and they tried having people first register and then vote. And while they were doing that, we'd be lucky to get one or two votes a day. And still in those days, I got 120 votes.
Wow.
Hard as it was. But I couldn't close the gap, obviously. So they decided eventually that people obviously like all three books.
Ah, okay.
Well, now, this is a contest sponsored by a radio station in San Diego, is that?
Sponsored by our public television
public radio. Okay.
And each city, they are different names. I remember in Chicago it was NPR, and here it's KPBS.
Okay. And
all the same thing.
And mm-hmm. they choose
so
three books.
Commercial free.
Now, do the books have to be written by San Diego authors?
No.
No. So they...
What it has to be, first of all, it's not just the station choosing it. There is a committee, and in that committee, there are some members of the San Diego Public Library, some of the KPBS, and some of the San Diego State University professors and so on. So the committee, everybody has to approve a book in order to make it. And there's a list of criteria for the book, which I remember there were 8 items on it, and mine had 7. You have to have at least 4 of them to get in, and mine had 7 of the 8. And the 8th that it didn't have was, it's not available in audiobook yet.
Mm.
So that could be changed. So it really fully qualified. But one of their main criteria is that the book should do something for the community.
Ah.
Should bring the community together or bring about community awareness or teach them something that makes our community stronger. And because I think there are over 60,000 Iranian Americans living in San Diego, and there are close to 2 million in California. Those who read it actually brought this up. At that point, I knew nobody in any of those three systems. But those who read it brought it up and recommended it, and they said, you know what, we didn't know any of this about our Iranians.
Really? Oh, well, so it's kind of a history book as well, then.
It is, and actually, two of the San Diego schools, prior to the selection for One Book, One San Diego, because their librarians read the book, they recommended that as a summer reading to their schools.
Oh, wonderful.
Because one of the librarians told me, you know, we could hit those kids on the head and say, go study recent history of the Middle East, and they wouldn't. They
no.
wouldn't read it. They would do nothing about it. I'm sorry if you hear it click. Somebody is trying to get on my line.
Well, that's, you know, that's really great, because when you can read history, I love historical fiction, when you can read history in that setting, and in the voice of a teenager, that's even better.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, the best compliment that I have received regarding this book is at one of the book discussions, a lady told me that she has an Iranian neighbor who used to have loud music, and they used too much fried onion in their food, and she was just bothered by all that. And ever since I read your story, I love their loud music, and I love their fried onion. Now, this is what you want when you spend years and years laboring over a book. You want your message to get home.
That's right.
Because
right.
what she's telling me is that for the first time, she sees her neighbor as people rather than a nuisance.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
As people that she could like and befriend. And that's what I wanted.
How long did it take you to write this book?
That's actually a very common question, and I almost always laugh when I want to answer it, because 24 years.
Okay. Okay, well,
wow. It's,
yeah. My next book is going to come out in 24 years. Actually, the next book being The Moon Daughter, I just finished, rewriting the last copy and sent it back to my editor, so it should be ready soon. I'm just dragging my feet because I published Sky of Red Poppies, and it did so great. Imagine if a big publisher now approaches me for the other book. I'm going to have less of that to do and more of my writing.
You're good. Listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Zoe Gottarmani, author of Sky of Red Poppies, which is a finalist and winner of One Book, One San Diego, an annual contest where librarians and others choose a book for all of San Diego to read. What are some of the events that will occur, some of the results of being in One Book, One San Diego, being a selection for that?
Well, so far, you get a one-way ticket to Cloud Nine.
Okay.
I think that's the most important aspect of it.
Right, right.
But what they do, first of all the libraries stock the book. They have to. They have to have it, they have to have discussions around it, and they welcome it, which is huge for an unknown author. This is huge.
Yes.
Yes.
And book clubs pick it up, but they had already picked mine up before that, lucky for me. And then the radio and TV will constantly announce it, and they arrange big events to include discussions and author talks and book signing. And
I mean, you couldn't buy this kind of publicity.
Absolutely not.
No,
I couldn't buy the one interview that I had with Maureen Cavanaugh, an anchor lady here at KPBS.
Wow.
I couldn't afford to buy a second of any of this. That is why I'm telling you I'm on cloud nine. I am the little book that could.
It really is. Well, I think one of the best things is that it was chosen to for the young people to read as an assignment. Because that's our future, and that's the future of the world. And if they understand another country a little bit better, it's great.
There's so many things I want to ask you about. Let's talk a little bit about. You said you had your group of writers that really supported you and were back there. I think I can. And
yeah,
how over the 24 years were these people involved during this whole time? And were you a member of a writers group where you were taking pieces in and they were commenting on them, or how did that work?
Well,
for you?
First of all, I have lived in San Diego for 11 years now.
Okay,
so I started Sky of Red Poppies while I was living in Chicago and practicing dentistry and teaching at Northwestern and raising my three kids. And I forgot to mention that the reason it took 24 years was because the last two chapters kept on changing. So I had to change accordingly. But when I came here, it was because I wanted to devote my life to dentistry. One day, I was just sitting there listening to the radio, and somebody came on and was giving life advice and said, if there's anything you've always wanted to do, do it. And I thought, aha, they're right. I have always wanted to be a writer. My family made me be a dentist later. And I am writing in hiding. Why am I doing that? I want to be a writer. So I called my secretary and put the practice up for sale, and I came home and I told my husband.
Wow.
That time when he thought I'm crazy, he was absolutely right, because my practice was at the peak of its success. I had 5,000 active patients.
Oh my goodness.
So I said, I want to go to California. And he just turned to me and said, with or without me? If you come, but I can go now and set up house or whatever, and you can come when you want. And of course he wouldn't do that. So he also gave the hospital a notice, and a year after that we were here. And then I went and signed up for evening classes to re-educate myself, get rid of the dental part and get more into literature. I took creative writing classes. I even took screenwriting classes and so on. And I went to a lot of conferences. I joined different groups of read and critique in town. And I went to Santa Barbara Writers Conference and became totally submerged in it.
Wow.
And you know what? If you ask me how old I am, I'm 11. And
that was such an amazingly brave and courageous thing to do, to basically leave your entire life behind to go be a writer. Why in California?
Yeah, that was my question. Why California?
When we came to visit here about 35 years ago, I fell in love with San Diego.
Oh.
I sort of felt like, oh, this is where I would love to live. And so I asked my husband, I said, will we ever live here? He says, oh, yeah, when we retire. I insisted, when will we retire? And he says, oh, I don't know, 2000. Retiring. It's 2000. We're moving to San Diego.
Oh, my. Your husband must be...
It sounded like he was just, you know, getting rid of me, because it's like you ask me, when is your next book coming out? And I say 2035.
Yeah, yeah.
Forget about it.
And you held him to it.
I reminded him of that, and he honored his promise.
He must have learned to be really careful about what he promises.
Yes. He's very careful about two things. What he promises, because he knows I'll never forget. And leaving town for longer than a week, because he knows I'll remodel the house.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, Zoe, when you started writing this book, which was set, you know, many years ago and based on partially on experiences that you had those many years ago, how did you remember all the details? Had you kept a journal during that time?
Yes. I don't know if you've read the book.
Oh, yes.
But there is a Phillips journal in that book, which is, you know, a Phillips calendar belonging to Phillips products. That is absolutely true. I still have it.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, that was
that brought back a lot of the material that I needed.
Wow.
That was something that...
Also, in between... I did meet with the protagonist, and she filled me in on some parts, too.
Mm. Was she really in prison?
She was.
Okay, okay.
Wow.
Well, you know, that was a very moving thing, too, because you said in the book, you said that, you know, her spirit was damaged, not just her,
yeah,
not physically, but emotionally, too. And I can understand how that can happen, of course.
And, you know, she is an example of many.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. She represents a whole bunch of young people who either had it worse or maybe a little bit less than her. But that is why most of the people from Iran who read it, they tell me that they relive a period of their life.
Wow.
That they had a similar teacher,
mm-hmm,
that they had a similar friend,
mm-hmm,
that they remember the street demonstration, you know? And I have tried to be very fair in that I don't still belong to any particular political or religious group. And I tried to write the book rather than be a writer with an opinion, I wanted to be a camera, just give you the picture of what was, without telling you who's good, who's bad, you know, what they should have done, and so on. Because there are a lot of good books that came out since the revolution, and from far stronger writers, but most of them have a hard time pulling themselves out of the book. Let's write about something that happened, and not, this shouldn't be all about me.
Right.
And actually, one of the reasons that the book took so long is that every time the editors would change it and say, listen, we want more of the narrator. And I'd say, the narrator did nothing. And they'd say, well, make her do things. But readers don't know that. Readers want her to be involved. But it's not my life. It is my emotion, not my life.
Now, what editors were you working with during this
process?
What editors? You talk about sending the book to editors and you know, getting the comments. What editors were you working with?
All sorts of editors. I mean, if you look at the acknowledgments, the only people I haven't thanked are the two of you right now. Have done so much for me, and I listen. One of my teachers said, "You know what? I can teach people how to write, but I can't teach them to be writers."
Yeah, exactly.
I went with that. I wrote that and put it on my wall and did not let anything discourage me. But it's the teachers who brought me here who were, for the sake of not having anything but a cliche, that they were the wind beneath my wings, helped me. And they put up with my accent, because when I would read, I don't read fast, and I'm not always clear, but they put up with so much. They put up with all my wrong exclamation marks. They taught me punctuation, and it has been a long process. You really are never too old to learn, and I have absorbed their lessons with gratitude, because when you're younger, you resent lessons. It's only when you're older that you consider what a gift they are.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Zoe Gadarmani, the author of Sky of Red Poppies. So, Zoe, after 24 years, how did you decide the book was finished and ready to go out into the world?
I realized that after what happened, you know, with the protagonist, that there was no more to this book, that there was no more story, that regardless of what changed, I wasn't going to change the story. Because I came across a part of the poem that the title of the book is based on. Because that poem started the friendship between the two girls. And that is reality. That's not fiction. But I only remember two verses of that poem. And it turns out we only knew two verses. We had never seen the whole poem. So I Googled it and I found out that the author son is living and lives in Malaysia, actually. I emailed him and I asked for the rest of the poem. And when I received it, I am not exaggerating, it made the hair on my arm stand. Because the lines that I didn't know of the poem were my friend's end of the story. So I had to change, and I had to include those lines. And then I thought, you know, I don't care what happens after this. I'm not going to change this.
You talk about this poem that was the behind the title, and you also have a little thing in the book about how important poetry is to Iranians. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Iranians are two things before they are born: poets and gardener. Because you can go to any Iran. I dare you to find a house of one Iranian without plants and flowers. Impossible. Give them a piece of land, and before you know it, there are roses and jasmines and whatnot, because that's what they like. And poetry used to be our basic literature. Until the 20th century, no Iranian writer had written anything fiction in prose.
Wow.
Every story was either a historical, fact-based story, or it was fictional poetry. And it was only in the 20th century that they decided, you know, we can write prose that is just as beautiful as poetry and tell stories. And it began then. So until then, the main part of our literature was poetry, and we have a gazillion good poets to fall back on. And in school, that was one of the requirements, to memorize long poems. And we had to, you know, we would be tested on it, and we would have to repeat and repeat until we knew it. And actually, one of the games that children play with their families is a game of poetry, where they divide into two teams, and one team will say one line of a poem, and that whatever letter that line ends in, the other team has to start a poem beginning with that letter. So even as kids, we played poetry. And what I write in the book about the illiterate coming up with the best line of poetry is true. You can even see trucks on the highway carrying garbage, and in the back of the truck, there's one line of poetry.
Wow.
Written down for you to read as you are behind that. You know, they constantly do that. And that's probably what makes a lot of our prose kind of lyrical.
Oh, I'm sure.
That's what... I'm sorry?
Oh, we said yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That makes
sense.
It's
part of our lives. So when we don't have the right word to express a meaning, we just quote a line of poetry.
Uh-huh.
Zoe, would you care to read from Sky of Red Poppies today?
Only if you want me to. Do you want me to read the beginning?
That would be perfect.
Yes, yes, lovely.
Yeah. Okay. What I love, after what I have said, this first paragraph that I put at the very beginning before chapter one, this may make a little bit more sense to you now. No one ever told me I would remember the hands that sculpted me, or that words could be carved into my soul. Now, decades later, I reminisce, sometimes with affection, but often not. It is the flexibility that I miss the most about my childhood. It is the remembrance of that innocence which helps me to forgive myself for who I have become. You want more?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay, chapter one. At 16, I was curious about many things. The activities of the Shah's secret police weren't among them. Mashhad, my hometown in northern Iran, had awakened to a rainy day in the spring of 1968. Taking hurried steps, my ponytail bouncing, I skipped over the puddles along the sidewalk. There were no students on the street, which could only mean I had already missed the first bell. Just as I was about to cross the street, a car sped past me, splashing rainwater over my clean shoes. I looked up and saw a black Mercedes making a U-turn. It parked in front of my school. Two men got out wearing huge sunglasses that covered half their faces, the kind that had become a trademark of the secret police. The mere sight of them was alarming, though I had no reason to think their presence had anything to do with me. Instinctively, I ducked into the small bookstore across from the school. Warm air and the smell of kerosene heater filled the shop. As I barged in, the old clerk rose halfway from his chair. Trying to catch my breath, I forced a smile despite the pump of blood rushing to my ears. I turned to the display window and picked up a book of calligraphy. I was familiar with those books and their curved letters, for I had stopped by many times to admire their colors, ornate frames, and miniature designs. But on that day, I looked beyond the case and watched those men across the street. They passed under the blue and white sign, Shard Oaks High School for Girls, hanging over the tall wooden doors that led to the walled-in school. One of them pushed the heavy door, and they both disappeared behind it. "Don't be scared, Miss Royale." The clerk's voice gave me a jolt, and I dropped the heavy book. A bookworm by reputation and a frequent visitor to his shop, I was no stranger to the old clerk. "They're not looking for you, are they?" He asked, his calm tone indicating he already knew the answer. I shook my head and wondered if he could hear the crazy beat of my heart. Is that enough?
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you can read more, but
yes, that's enough to, I think, to whet people's interest.
Yeah. Now,
the revolution against the Shah, of course, was eventually successful, and I'm assuming the political prisoners would have all been released after that. But did things really change in Iran?
Yes and no. Some political prisoners were released. Some were killed. More prisoners were taken. And yes, things changed, but don't ask me whether it's for better or worse, because I'm not there to judge. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, let's put it this way, I don't think this is what those student demonstrators wanted.
Right.
Now, the Shah did...
And I don't use the American expression is from the pot to the frying pan. The Persians say from a ditch into a well.
Ah, okay.
That is where we went, from a ditch to a well.
Now, the Shah, that was a monarchy, wasn't it?
Yes.
So that
actually, what I have said about the Shah is very much true in my family. My father was an imperialist, and he really made us stand up when the national anthem came.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a portrait of him in his office. So, yeah, I grew up in an imperialist family, and I never did anything against it. But I could see that the others had concerns. And actually, I have met the Shah on three separate occasions, and he was so darn likable when you met him that you couldn't believe all the stories that you would hear on the street.
Mm. Well, now he
smiled and always looked at you as if he remembered you from the last time, which I'm sure he didn't. But as a young girl, you don't know that, and so sort of says, "Oh, it's you again." You know?
Right. Wow. He did some good things, like the agricultural reforms, which, of course, your father lost some of his wealth in that, but still he wasn't against the Shah even after that.
No. He had doubts as to whether he should be as loyal as he was.
Uh-huh.
But so were a lot of people. You see, people did not turn against the Shah overnight.
Okay.
It wasn't something that, and I have a feeling that if, let's say, if he was in good health, and if 3 years into the revolution, welcome him again. Because this had happened in the past, and they did. He did go out, and he came back.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
That if he thought he would never come back, he might not have left.
Ah.
But he had a previous history, and he thought maybe right now it's safer that we get out.
Uh-huh.
There was never the kind of general hatred that you see in some other countries. People were always divided. But then again, people are divided in most any country. You can't find everybody loving
exactly.
the same person.
No.
There are always opposition.
Oh, yes.
And the history, when we look at history, there tends to be an inclination to think, for example, that, you know, everyone wanted the Shah out, you know, that the people, all of the people were against the Shah, or this spring that everybody wanted the Egyptian president out, but it's not really the case. It's just that the history is written from the perspective of whoever won.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And as is the history with forgiving the wrongdoings of the dead, I think that the more time passes, the more people miss him.
Oh.
Because he did do many good things.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Zoe Gadamani, author of Sky of Red Poppies.
Now, where can we get your book? Because, well, we have a copy, but there are going to be some people that are going to want to read this. Where can they get your book?
They can either get it from Turquoise Books directly, that's turquoisebooks.org, or they can get it from Amazon, or they can order it to their bookstores and libraries. At this point, I think because Baker and Taylor carries it, libraries can order their own copy.
Ah.
Great.
So these are mainly, and bookstores usually get it from Ingram, and Ingram is my distributor. They can get it through that. But either order it to your local bookstore, independent bookstore, or order it to Barnes & Noble, or ask your library to have it.
Great. Now, how did you publish? You said you self-published. You want to talk a little bit about what made you decide to do that and what the process was like?
You know, to publish, you first need an agent. And I never had trouble finding an agent. Agents seemed to like the book. They could see the potential in it. And my New York agent was trying to get a very big deal for it, because she sort of compared it to, I won't name them, but some of the great books that recently came out.
Right.
And she knew that she would be able to get a good deal on it. But she only applied to those big houses. And before she had gotten the chance to go to small houses, we went through this problem with economy and this and that. And I thought, I wanted to get this book published. I wanted to get this book in the hands of people, and I was getting impatient. So I called my agent, and I asked her to terminate our contract. And she was very sorry, and I love her, and we are still very good friends, and I'm hoping that when the final deals for translations come through, that she will still represent me, and she says that she will. But I wanted to get this book out there, and I am so glad I did. Meanwhile, my daughter, who is a lawyer, has been publishing in the past, and she came to me and said, you know what, publishing is changing so much. I think this is a decision for you, so go ahead, Mom, publish it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to do it. You know how some self-published books have the look of a self-published book?
I do. I think we discussed that when we were on the beach in Santa Barbara. We were talking about that.
Yes, exactly. You look at this book and you see that it's, you know, somebody really worked hard on getting it together and making it look nice.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
And one of my daughters is an artist. I always say in my talks when they say, what's the secret to your success? And I say, if you want to be a successful writer, first give birth and raise your team. My son is my webmaster. My middle daughter is my artist, designer, coordinator, and my oldest daughter is my attorney and publicist. So, so I have my whole team, and my husband, of course, subsidizes the whole program.
Yes,
so
yes.
It's a family thing, and all I have to do then is write.
Ah.
We did this, and then we picked the name Turquoise Book, and we registered it as a publishing house and got the ISBN and everything for it, and then I published. But it has been worthwhile, because look where I am now.
Oh, absolutely.
Had I waited, I may or may not have a small contract in my pocket by now, but the book wouldn't be out yet.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Because even if a publisher picks it up, it's a couple of years before it's out.
Now, with the type of momentum that this book has been getting, it's possible that one of those big houses will come back now and want it. You know, want to reissue it.
Well, they're welcome to it at this point, because I've had my try. I have done, you know, the little engine got to the top.
That's right.
I can let somebody else drive it. You know, I don't mind. Actually, that gives me more time to write, because this past few months have been so, it's been so difficult to finish The Moon Daughter and do all the publicity for this and promotion for this book, because I travel, I tour. I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. in September to be a speaker at a major cultural seminar. And I'll have book signings there. I went to Northern California, spoke at Berkeley, spoke at San Francisco State. I went to Chicago, spoke at University of Chicago, at Northeastern, and so on. So I've been active doing all of this and still writing. And anyone who's a writer knows this is not to go. We're back to having a dental practice and writing.
Right. I was
That's not the way to go.
Yeah.
So I'm no publisher, and I'll welcome any publisher to come and take this off my hand. But if they don't, I'm behind my books.
Of course, nowadays, you still, even with a major publisher, they want you to do the tour and do the speaking and do the promoting as much as possible.
Yes,
too,
but so. What I am doing now is I'm organizing interviews, I'm organizing events,
right.
I am even going around looking for who can review my book. Once a big publisher, there was somebody from LA Times who loved my book, but said, we can't review your book because LA Times has a rule. No self-published books are reviewed.
Oh, my.
Wow. Huh. So you see, when you have a big publisher, those hurdles are not there.
That is true.
They tell you, you have to go to Boston next, and you go. Or that are willing to take you.
So do you have
to that bookstore.
Do you have plans now for...
You know, I have to write, and I have to say, listen, I'm really good. You should have me. And half of them say, well, so say you.
Do you have plans now for another book? Another story?
Sorry?
Do you have plans for another book now?
Now, you're working on Moon Daughter.
But I have two books waiting.
Two books waiting.
I have already finished The Moon Daughter. That's pretty much ready to go.
And what's that about?
And, The Moon Daughter is about two women. It compares life in general. It is about women, and it parallels the lives of an American woman and an Iranian woman.
Mm.
It is about a mother and daughter, just like, let's say, my life and my daughter's life, and the cultural differences and the differences in their freedom. and how much control they have over their destinies or don't have. So that's all fiction. But the good news is that the first time that my editor read it, she said, "Ah, this is the book. What were you doing with the puppies?" That's good.
Oh,
well,
boy.
So we have more to look forward to.
Yes.
Well, Zoe, we're out of time, and I so much enjoyed having you on the show. I'm so glad I met you in Santa Barbara. I think that that you are going to, I mean, you've already had tremendous success, but I see even greater success coming your way with this in your future books.
Thank you so much, Monica. It is my pleasure to know you too. And I really appreciate this interview, and I appreciate all the support you've given me. And I look forward to seeing you again maybe next year.
Well, my daughter's moving to L.A. in a week, so I will be in California at some point for sure.
Okay, if you come down to San Diego, please call me. I'm listed in the phone book. We live in La Jolla.
And I have your number. So
I can email you the phone number.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, Mom, you have some final words for us today?
Yeah, I do have some final words, and this certainly does not apply to this lady. Thomas Merton said that the biggest human temptation is to settle for too little, and she certainly did not do that.
No, she's a...
And for an ending, I can give you my motto in life, which I heard someone say it, but it says, "For true success, you should start at the top and then work your way up." And I think One Book, One San Diego is allowing me to do that.
I think so,
too. Oh, congratulations. Great.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you missed part of this interview, we'll be rebroadcasting Monday morning at 8 a.m., and you'll also be able to pick it up in a week or two on the web at writersvoices.com and KRUUFM.com. And stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Erstwhile, because, wow, we've got James Moore has some great things lined up, an interview with Jeffrey Hedquist, an interview with Ari Berman, an interview with Julia Ross about the Beauty Shop's new project, an interview with Scott Morris about the Hometown Hero Rewards program. And see you next week on Writers' Voices.